You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with C. Bangs. C, I want to thank you for being with me today.
Thanks for interviewing me.
So there's a number of things I want to talk about, and some of it is the work you've done with collaborations, but let's talk about what you're working on now. I know you have a recent collaboration you're coming from. Is that true?
Yes, it is. I just finished a residency through the gallery that I show at, which is Central Booking Art Space on 21 Ludlow Street in the Lower East Side, and that was with the New York Academy of Medicine. And I was one of five artists who were selected to work at the New York Academy of Medicine, which is at 103rd and 5th Avenue, in their rare book room. And I was a 6-month residency where I could work on any topic, and the topic that I selected, which I wasn't planning on, I went in there thinking about the book that Greg and I had just done on panpsychism, and so I was looking sort of with those eyes, and I stumbled upon a flower called the flowering pavonis, which was used for many centuries by Native women to abort their unwanted children because they were either slaves or had been mistreated in some way. And so it was a long-standing understanding of how to use this plant that they used in addition for many other things. So I worked with that particular plant, and in addition, some of the images of Robert Flood, who I'd never heard of, who was a 15th century English physician who had studied widely in Europe, and that sort of touched on the panpsychism idea, because he was a scholar in addition to being a physician and something of a polymath. And his images in the rare book room, which are accessible to the public if you make an appointment at the New York Academy of Medicine, are truly extraordinary. I was absolutely blown away by them. So that was my 6-month residency, and then the.
In what sense? Describe the drawings a little bit. Like, what was so extraordinary? And we also have to get into panpsychism, because though I interviewed Greg. The listeners don't know exactly what that is yet, but first, right, tell me about the drawings a little bit that were so extraordinary.
Well, some of them were actually really reminiscent of Da Vinci. I mean, they had, because he was a physician, he was very interested in anatomy and also the workings of many things. So he did many experimental drawings of light and how sound travels. But the drawings that I was so amazed at were like little cross sections. They looked like mandalas, but they were cross sections of what he, you know, I think he was trying to get at sort of a universal consciousness. To me, I mean, that's what they looked like to me. They're basically all round, and in some ways, some of them have very, very dark centers with perhaps a little bit of light. Others have sort of light emanating from them, but they all are sort of alluding to me, from my point of view, towards the idea of a consciousness that happens throughout the cosmos.
And so, is that what panpsychism is? Because you haven't actually defined it, and
right, right.
Greg does, the scientist that you talked about briefly in the interview that I did with him, partly about your work with him. So what is this panpsychism, and if I'm saying it right, and what does that have to do with Greg Matlow?
Well, panpsychism is a very ancient idea that has been updated and now is in the purview of science as well as philosophy, which is the belief that consciousness, whether you want to put spiritual idea onto that, or simply a scientific idea that there is a form of volition throughout nature, in inanimate as well as animate objects. And humankind came out of, this is a very ancient idea that humankind has had forever. The universe was very alive, stars were alive, planets were alive, before we knew what planets were, but certainly stars were alive in ancient traditions. And it's been updated because scientists are looking into the possibilities of why certain things are done that they don't really understand. And so they're trying to look for evidence of why that would occur. Such as the stars that seem to have volitional movement that is not, that is against what they would believe that gravity would have them do. And what is happening in the scientific community among some is there's a belief in dark matter. But the problem with dark matter is that in the scientific community it can be added or subtracted by what you need in terms of if you need a little more dark matter, you can put in a little more dark matter in your equation. If you need a little less, you can put in a little less. So it doesn't really work scientifically. It works more philosophically, dark matter. And so that whole discussion in the science community is up for debate now. And that's the work that Greg and I did in two books. One is Starlight, Star Bright, Are Stars Conscious? And we did that in 2015. And then we did an artist-scientist book that I was the lead in this. So I used images that Greg then responded to in prose. And that was Star Bright with a question mark.
And that's so interesting. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about both of those books. But first, how did the collaboration with Mark begin? I've already interviewed him, as I've said, so he's a fascinating guy. And, of course, interviewed him because you suggested that before we talked. And with artists these days, collaborations, you know, are happening more and more. And this is a particularly wonderful example. So how did this begin? How did you meet Mark? And then, yeah, I'd like to get into the details of the book.
Well, it's actually Greg. But
I'm sorry, Greg.
That's okay. Many people do Greg, that. Yes. No worries. That seems to be the default on his name. I met Greg years and years ago. We've been together and married since 1986. But before that, even, we were working together when we met initially at Pratt Institute, where he was heading up the center for at that time computing and working with a very large mainframe that enabled me and other faculty and alumni to do then computer art, which was newer at that time in 86. So we met through a friend, and then as an alumni I worked with him, as did others at the center at Pratt, and we started collaborating because when we met, we talked about the mythology in addition to the science of ideas. And when we met, we had this long discussion on Arecibo and how it's the radio telescope in Puerto Rico that, in addition to being a device for listening and detecting asteroids, it's also something of a mythological idea that humankind has a giant ear listening out in, you know, listening for the sounds of space, basically, and what that means, what the mythology of the science.
It's wonderful, yeah. I mean, that does seem like it's such a rich and evocative myth, and I talked with him also a little bit about a listening, you know, when it came, that was a slightly different subject I think he was on, when we were talking about just why we don't hear from alien life, and And he was saying, you know, one theory is perhaps they're, you know, they're all listening. We're the only ones broadcasting so much.
Right.
And but tell me a little bit about the book, about consciousness and how that was approached. And then I love the idea of the other one of him reacting in prose. But what's in that book and how did that proceed?
Well, the book Starlight, Star Bright, Our Stars Conscious covers a very wide range, going back from, you know, when humankind really did believe, our ancient ancestor did believe in stars having a consciousness and a mythology to them, and all the myths and the naming actually of the stars reflect that, and then it traces what Greg had looked into, which is there was a conference on Olaf Stapleton, who wrote Star Maker, in London about 10 years ago. And instead of doing the usual, which is his work on solar sails or propulsion, he decided to look into the mythology of Star Maker. And in Star Maker, Stapleton explores the idea that stars have a volition and are conscious in one way or another. And incidentally, that was the book that when Greg and I first started dating that he read to me when I was in my studio, which is a very fond memory of both of ours.
I love that. I love that. That sounds so romantic in a way, you know, a very different kind of romance, but that does sound kind of a wonderfully romantic.
It was extraordinary because the book is breathtaking, and it's a visionary book that many scientists have been able to work off of, because the ideas are very probing and visionary, and yet there seems to be a hint of the possibility of something in them other than the mythology and the vision. So scientists have used Stapleton's work, and in particular Star Maker, for a long time, actually. And then Greg looked into the idea of a volitional, what could make a star move differently instead of dark matter, because he had a student who challenged him on you know, why can't we find it after 100 years, basically, of looking for it. And so he looked into it, and there was a Russian scientist, Pavel Perengo, who really studied the idea of volitional, of why a star would move volitionally. And Greg went into that and discovered there is Perengo's discontinuity, it's called, which talks about why they would move in a different way and what possibilities there could be about that. So that's very much part of the book. That's perhaps the meat of the book, why the scientific investigation of why this would be possible. And then after the mythology and the science and other possibilities, because there is a new search that will, the data will come out hopefully next year, perhaps a bit later, on looking more closely at these anomalous movements of stars. And that then went into Star Bright, or actually Star Bright proceeded, because I was, we were working with a new publisher, and I wanted to, I had done one other book that was based on books that we have done together, but after the fact, so I wanted to jumpstart this one. So I had prepared images anyway, and I was, these images start out, because I'm an academically trained artist, as painted panels that are on display now at Central Booking Art Space. And then I incorporate the paintings into a digital collage that are then part of the chapter frontispieces for both books.
That's exciting. And in the second book, which you said is, that's Starlight, is that correct?
No, Starbright, like Starlight, Starbright. Starbright, but with a question mark, is the Starbright.
And how is he kind of riffing on your images? How does that work? Because that's, I like that idea as it's collaborative. And how does that work?
Well, he Greg actually really loves poetry, and so he many times starts. In fact, all of times he starts his books on astrophysics with a poem, a little part of a poem at the beginning of the chapter, and so he perhaps wanted to to sort of venture into that idea, and we had been working on these ideas basically in parallel ideas for a long time. So he just looked at the images and wrote maybe five or six lines responding to the image that would basically boil down the concept to a poetic prose-like response to the image.
And how do you feel that turned out? How do you both like because I love that way of artists collaborating, of artists and scientists rather collaborating, because it doesn't lend itself to illustration in a sense. It's more text and image talking to one another in a sense.
Right. Well, that's really important to me because, one of the very bad words that you could be called as an art student was an illustrator. I have nothing against illustrators, but that was not considered a good thing. So I've never called myself an illustrator. And when I worked, I was a NASA faculty fellow for 4 summers. And when I worked at Marshall Space Flight Center, I worked as an artist as opposed to a designer or an illustrator.
Let's talk a little bit about that before we go. The NASA, mm-hmm. the work, that was the work you were doing there, which is what you were just saying, correct?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that was actually a very that was between the summers of 2001 to 2004, and Greg and I would go down to Huntsville, Alabama, where we would work with the colleague who has worked with many of the books, Les Johnson, who's the Advanced Concepts Manager at Marshall, and. We would work on a variety of things that he would help us select, because as a NASA faculty fellow, which I think they're finally renewing this long-time possibility for faculty people, that you go down and you're sort of in a pool of NASA faculty fellows and people who are in the division that you are working with decide whether they want to work with an artist or a philosopher or a historian or of course an engineer or coming from the outside as opposed to being inside. So what would happen is that the initial week or two would be there would be a lot of projects that were thrown at you. Or at me in this case, and out of that it would seem, then Les or the project manager would help the individual faculty fellow select what would work best for what they were planning to, what NASA was interested in really following through on and having a little additional outside input into. So the first summer I worked investigating a holographic solar sail that I did. I did a prototype for at the Hollow Center before I went. And then the second summer, which is when I really started responding through images directly with other scientists and engineers, I worked on a project that was called Manufacturing in Space. And that was quite exciting, and that was the basis of a lot of books that Greg and I then went on to do later, including paradise regained and living off the land and space and harvesting space for a greener earth, and a whole variety of books on that idea. Because manufacturing in space is an idea whose time has come and should be investigated a lot more, because it would actually help ecologically with a lot of things that we're dealing with now.
And in terms of how you're producing images in your studio or with NASA, it's a combination of things, right? You're using digital processes and printmaking processes. What is your preferred way of working, and how are these images being built?
Well, it doesn't, you know, there is, I mean, as I said, I'm classically trained, so I love to paint. I have a lot of paintings that I'm surrounded with in my studio, and also that are exhibited at Central Booking Art Space in addition to other places. But I start with the thing that seems most logical, and by the way, that does include printmaking as well, but the most logical way to get around an idea. So the book that we are starting to work on, which is about alien megastructures, I'm starting with a very simple drawing, and it will be initially a black and white drawing where I will probably scan that into to the computer and then work with either public domain images that I can find or whatever. I mean, it'll be whatever occurs to me as the project develops. And that's really what the manufacturing in space idea started out as, that I worked with drawings initially, and when I was attending this conference that went on for I think about 2 weeks, I would just simply draw some of the ideas that they were talking about, and then I would take them back, scan them in digitally, figure out what should go with them. Again, when I was at NASA, I was working with the images there. So, you know, the public domain or the NASA images when I was working at Marshall. So I combine them and then reconfigure them in what way makes most sense for the individual idea.
I love that, and it's great talking about that process as well as your work with them. Before I ask you the last question, though, there's a term that probably listeners don't know, which I know a little bit about from talking to Greg yesterday, which was alien megastructures. Right? It's an incredible sounding term that I had never heard before. And so could you just define what that is, an alien megastructure?
Yeah, well, that's the idea, and it's a very ancient, not ancient, but it's a very old idea in science fiction, that very advanced civilizations, perhaps millions of years in advance of our civilization, would construct structures in space that could surround their stars, could include their planets, could use the energy from their sun. Some alien megastructures have been proposed that would actually move their entire solar system. Some alien megastructures would be designed so that as their star becomes ready to expand which our star will do at some point in billions of years' time, and then contract, that they could stabilize the movement of the star so that they could extend its lifetime for a longer amount of time.
These structures, of course, which are of course massive, as big as the, you know, bigger than the sun or the solar system. These are theories, theoretical structures, of course. Correct?
Well, they are definitely theoretical structures. But what scientists are believing are seeing now, with the research that they're looking at for Tabby's star, is they think that they are seeing indications that don't look like anything they've seen before. And so one of the ideas that is being played with is perhaps this is an alien megastructure or a Stapleton Dyson dome.
And then which is exactly? What's it called? It hasn't been seen close enough to know, I guess, right?
The star is called Tabby's star. I'm not sure. You'd have to ask Craig for that. Or I can email you the name, the scientific name.
That's fine, yeah.
Yeah. And Tabby is the first name of the woman who is leading one of the teams to do research on it. But she was the one who discovered it, actually.
Fascinating. Look forward to hearing more about that. Before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading now. What books could be off topic or not that you're reading?
Well, I'm reading a book called Phi, P-H-I, and the other name is A Voyage from the Brain to the Soul by Julio Tonioni.
See, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure hearing about your work and collaborations.
Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.